The upside of irrationality. The unexpected benefits of defying logic at work and at home. Author, Dan Ariely. The unexpected ways we defy logic at work. More than a century ago, psychologists Robert Yerkes and John Dudson performed different experiments in an effort to find out two things about rats. How fast they could learn, and what intensity of electric shocks would motivate them to learn fastest. When the shocks were very weak, the rats were not very motivated, and as a consequence, they learned slowly. When the shocks were of medium intensity, the rats were more motivated and they learned faster. Up to the point, the results fit with our intuition about the relationship between motivation and performance. But here was the catch. When the shock intensity was very high, the rats performed worse. We are usually quick to assume that there's a link between the magnitude of the incentive and the ability to perform better. It seems reasonable that the more motivated we are to achieve something, the harder we will work to reach our goal, and this increased effort will ultimately move us closer to our objectives. This, after all, is part of the rationale behind paying stockbrokers and CEOs sky-high bonuses. Offer people a very large bonus, and they will be motivated to work and perform at very high levels. The experiment showed that the incentives can be a double-edged sword. Up to a certain point, they motivate us to learn and perform well. But motivational pressure can be so high that it actually distracts an individual from concentrating on and carrying out a task. The meaning of labor. On an intuitive level, most of us understand the deep interconnection between identity and labor. Our jobs are an integral part of our identity, not merely a way of earning a living. In contrast to this labor-identity connection, the basic economic model of labor generally treats workers as rats in a maze. Work is assumed to be annoying, and all the rat wants to do is to get to the food, with as little effort as possible, and to rest on a full belly, for the most time possible. The idea of labor division is one of the dangers of work-based technology. Modern IT infrastructure allows us to break projects into very small, discrete parts, and assign each person to do only one of the many parts. Highly divisible labor might be efficient if people were automatons. But given the importance of internal motivation and meaning to our drive in productivity, this approach might backfire. They have little desire to put their hearts and soul into their labor. If companies really want their workers to produce, they should try to impart a sense of meaning by allowing them to feel a sense of completion and ensuring that a job well done is acknowledged. Customization, labor, and love. At the birth of the automotive industry, Henry Ford quipped that any customer could have a Model T painted any color they wanted, so as long as it was black. Producing cars in just one color kept costs low, so that more people could afford them. Fast forward to today, you can find millions of products to suit your taste. Thanks to improvements in internet technology and automation, manufacturers are allowing customers to create products that fit their individual idiosyncrasies. You can, for example, pick the style of the shoe you want, the material, the color, and so on. Thus, you receive not only a product that you really like, but one that is unique to you. This does not necessarily mean that companies should always require their customers to do the design, work, and labor on every product. There's a delicate trade-off between effortlessness and investment. Ask people to expend too much effort, and you can drive them away. Ask them for too little effort, and you're not providing the opportunities for customization. It all depends on the importance of the task and on the personal investment in the product category. As companies start to understand the true benefits of customization, they might start generating products that allow customers to express themselves and ultimately give them higher value and enjoyment. Any solution, as long as it's mine. Our understanding of human attachment to self-made physical goods extends to our attachment to ideas as well. This bias extends beyond the examples of a few individuals. Companies tend to create cultures centered around their own beliefs, language, processes, and products. Subsumed by such cultural forces, the people working within a company tend to accept internally developed ideas as more useful and important than those of individuals and organizations. Thus, the same thing that happens with our creations happens with our ideas. As long as we create it, we tend to feel rather certain that it's more useful and important than similar ideas that other people come up with, which is called the non-invented here mentality. Our tendency to overvalue what we create is a mixed bag of good and bad. Our task is to figure out how we can get the most good and the least bad out of ourselves. Why we get used to things, but not all things. Adaptation is a very important novelty filter that helps us focus our limited attention on things that are changing and might therefore pose either opportunities or danger. Adaption allows us to attend to the important changes, among the millions that occur around us all the time and ignore the unimportant ones. It turns out that we are very good at conceiving the future, but we can't foresee how we will adapt to it. It's difficult to imagine that, over time, you might get used to the changes in your lifestyle, adapt to your injuries, and find that it's not as terrible as you once thought. It's even harder to imagine discovering new and unexpected joys in your new situation. Our studies have shown that we adapt more quickly and to a larger degree than we can imagine. Adaptation and pain. Hannon Frank, a professor who joined the army and left with two amputated legs, decided to set an experiment on what pain can teach us about adaptation. Even though the people in the study had endured their injuries many years before, their overall approach to pain and ability to tolerate it seemed to have changed, and this change lasted for a long time. Why we should not act on our negative emotions. Emotions disappear without a trace. However, Eduardo Andrade, a professor at the University of California, wondered whether the effects of emotions could still affect decisions we make far into the future. His basic logic was this. Imagine that something happens that makes you feel happy and generous. Say that your favorite team wins the match. That night, you are having dinner at your aunt's. And while in this great mood, you impulsively decide to buy her flowers. A month later, the emotions of the big win faded away, and it's time for another visit to your aunt. You think about how a good nephew should act. You consult your memory and you remember your wonderful flower buying act from your last visit, so you repeat it. You then repeat the ritual over and over until it becomes a habit. Even though the underlying reason for your initial action is no longer present, you take your past actions as an indication of what you should do next. That way, the effects of the initial emotion end up influencing a long string of your decisions. Why we need to test everything. Experiments are important as one of the best ways to learn what really works and what does not seem uncontroversial. However, such importance isn't recognized when it comes to important decisions in business or public policy. We are often amazed by the audacity of the assumptions that business people and politicians make, coupled with their seemingly unlimited convention, that their intuition is correct. But politicians and business people are just people, with the same decision biases we all have.